With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Attention all personnel. Please clear the launching area.
Fire.
Oh, baby. I'll give it to you.
That looks really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, sir.
Welcome to Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists, and I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. This time we'll be hearing about the Zombies of the Cosmos, a new comms system for the space station, and celebrating the life of an astronaut equivalent to Mad Men's Don Draper, Alan Shepard.
Our guest is science journalist and author Katia Moskvich. We're going to talk about neutron stars, Katia, a little later on. That's your book. But let me just get a comment from you, first of all, on the news that ESA, the European Space Agency, is going to recruit another lot of astronauts. I mean, that's quite exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really cool, actually. When I saw it yesterday on LinkedIn, a former acquaintance of mine who now works in the communications department of ESA, he put it on LinkedIn, and I was the first to react saying, you know, I'm in. I've sent you my CV. Let me know the launch date. So that was quite funny. But it is incredibly exciting, of course. And I know it's the first time since 2008. And they're also going to be flying astronauts with disabilities. So I'm not exactly sure how exactly they're going to do it. I don't think they're sure themselves yet what route they're going to take. But it's incredibly exciting for sure.
It is. And I would have thought you'd be in with a good chance, as is. We've had a guest on the programme, Susie Imbar, who is a space scientist, works on the Bepi Colombo mission. She won the British TV programme series, So You Want to Be an Astronaut. She's incredibly fit. I don't want to put you off, Katia. I'm not saying she's competition, but, you know, she climbs mountains. But they also specified, although we don't have all the details yet, because all the full details will come out in a press conference, they did say they wanted more women, which is brilliant, as well as this para-astronaut feasibility study, which would sort of make sense, because if your disability, for instance, is that you can't walk or you're in a wheelchair, who needs to walk in space?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it does make total sense. And I think it's opening a lot of doors, and it's changing so much. I remember I wanted to be an astronaut when I was in high school many years ago. I actually went to the same high school as Julie Payette, the second female astronaut in Canada. Yeah, I saw her portrait on the wall, and I was just so amazed that she went to the same school. And I wrote her this letter and I said, look, I'm 15. I don't know where to go study because I want to be just like you and I want to be an astronaut. And she actually replied. She wrote me a letter back, actually a postcard with some ISS on it and Canada Arm, the robotic arm that, you know, helps spacecraft to get attached to the International Space Station. And she said, she advised me to go and study either engineering or science, which I did. I went and studied engineering, and then I wanted to go to space and be like a jet pilot. But unfortunately, they told me I couldn't be a pilot because of my vision. My vision wasn't 100%. So it brings us back to the criteria today, right? Like today, I don't think that would be a problem at all. Like if you don't have perfect vision or whatever disability you might have, I think with this particular round of recruitment, they're indeed opening a lot of doors to people to apply and go to space and experience it and maybe bring, bring some value. Because if you do have a specific talent, but you have a disability, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to go and contribute somehow to whatever it is you want to do.
Well, I'm colorblind. Does that count?
Yeah. And my disability is age, I think, because I suspect I will be above the age.
Well, John Glenn went into space.
But yeah. He'd already gone before.
What's interesting now is, particularly with the SpaceX spacecraft, it's back to the shuttle. You can have passengers again. It's not like Soyuz, where everyone really needs to know what they're doing and they're crammed into this tiny little capsule. SpaceX is much more like a bus. You know, it can actually just carry people who don't particularly have to engage unless something goes really badly wrong.
Yeah, indeed. And that's why I think in the future we'll have more and more space tourism as well. So anyone will be able to go, you know, maybe zoom around the Earth and go back again. Just take a few pictures and kind of remember it forever. It would be amazing.
Obviously, we need a journalist to go into space. Now, you were born in the Soviet Union. I mean, we were talking about this just before we started, and you were actually born in Siberia. You know, having Russian, that's gonna give you a little bit of an edge when it comes to the fight between the various science
between
journalists.
You and Susie,
yeah, exactly, three of us about who goes. But I'm always intrigued by the way astronauts or cosmonauts are portrayed, particularly were in the Soviet Union. I mean, I've been to Mission Control Moscow quite a few times now, and there's this, I mean, it's almost religious. It's almost like this you know, the sort of iconography of Gagarin's and people reaching for the stars. I mean, it's extraordinary, that, but it doesn't seem to be there anymore. It seems to be a relic of the Soviet Union rather than what Russia is now doing in space.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it goes back to the Cold War and the space race and Russia or the Soviet Union at the time trying to be better. And they were so much better than everybody else, you know. They've achieved so much, so many firsts, starting from Sputnik, the first satellite being launched into space, to, of course, the first dog, to the two dogs that came back alive, and then the first person to go to space, and so many more. And I mean, now, yes, unfortunately, so much has changed. And I don't know what the future of the Russia space program is going to be, because there have been so many delays and failures. And now with SpaceX, for I think 9 years now, Americans have been using Russian rockets to get to the ISS. That was the only way. But, you know, obviously that's going to change. So I don't know what's going to happen. It's a bit sad. And Gagarin legacy, people still remember him, but I think probably people of older generation remember him. Like if you ask a 10-year-old right now in Russia whether they know who Gagarin is, I don't think every 10-year-old is going to tell you, which is really sad.
Wow. It's really sad. You've been to the Gagarin Museum, haven't you? The actual in his, the village of his of where he's from.
Yes, exactly. So I did a story for the BBC at the time on the anniversary of human spaceflight, and I went to his birth village of Klushino, which is about just 30 minutes by train from Moscow. But I was surprised just how difficult it is to actually get there. So you take the train, but then from the train, you got to catch a bus or a taxi to get there through dirt roads. And finally, you get to this completely remote, abandoned village. And there's this maybe just a handful of houses still standing where, you know, some old people are still living. And his house has been transformed into a museum, but nobody's visiting. Some volunteers are looking after it. And it was just very sad and unfortunate. Like, I wouldn't imagine anything like that in the West, right? Like, if the first person to go to space was from the US or anywhere else in the West, really, I think it would have been a very different picture. And so his legacy, like, nobody goes to that museum. Nobody would know, like, 10 years from now, many people wouldn't know who he was. And that's very, very sad.
I'm surprised, actually, because one of the things that has proliferated over the last few years has been Yuri's Night, which is a really sort of popular way of getting together and celebrating Yuri Gagarin. This year it's the 12th of April. So it sounds like maybe it's closer to home then, that recognition is dwindling.
Well, no, I mean, in Russia people still celebrate his birthday at 12th of April. It's still called the Day of Cosmos. And people will still probably remember him and remember that he was the guy who went into space for the first time, but people wouldn't know who he is. And I just wonder if, like, if a kid would look at his portrait and remember straight away who that person is. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. They will remember the feat, but they won't remember the details.
Well, you're right. I did a talk in a local school a few years ago, and it was sixth formers, so aged between 16 and 18. And I showed a picture of Valentina Tereshkova, and no one knew who she was. No one recognised her. And even when I said her name, I got blank faces, and I was quite honestly shocked. It's not just Russian history, it's the world's history. The first woman in space.
Of course, yes, it's, yeah, I agree. Very shocking and sad.
Well, we'll come back again to you shortly when we'll talk about neutron stars. But let's go to what happened a few weeks ago when two NASA astronauts began the installation of a new antenna on the space station. It's called COLCA, short for Columbus, Ka-band terminal, because it's being attached to the station's ESA science laboratory, Columbus. Funded by the UK Space Agency, it's the UK's first big industrial contribution to the ISS and will upgrade communications for European astronauts to family and researchers on the ground. Designed and built by MDA UK in Harwell, Oxfordshire, I spoke to its managing director, David Kenyon, about the device and started by asking how he felt after the fridge-sized COLCA, which was flown up to the space station last year, was finally being attached to the space station.
Okay, I have the large hook of the Erect, and we're keeping this one?
We are keeping that one. That's a permanent.
NASA astronaut Mike Hopkins, now out of the crew lock. He's working with NASA astronaut Victor Glover to transfer the COLCA, or Columbus Ka band antenna, which they brought out of the airlock with them. They'll then head over to the Columbus module.
There's nothing like live operations. I spent 6 years in Darmstadt doing flight operations and went through two launch campaigns, including being on console for a live operation, and there's no excitement quite like actually seeing something happening in space. And of course, in those days, we didn't have any video. It was all just telemetry. But to actually see the COLCA terminal attached to the end of the Canada arm, also made by MDA, being swung around by the astronauts. It's almost unreal, exciting, terrifying. You're just hoping it's all going to go well.
I can understand the terror because you've obviously, having built and designed this, your investment is pretty total, isn't it?
Well, this terminal has created MDA in the UK. I mean, we've had a presence here for many years in different guises, but this is the one that's really established us here, has built the team. It's our first project, our first piece of proper flight hardware. And to see it up there and about to sort of really add value was, you know, it's really exciting.
So what situation is it at the moment on the space station?
The terminal has been successfully positioned, bolted to the structure. The power has been connected and the terminal is communicating. So it's now ready to continue with in-orbit tests. So we gradually switch on the various units and check out the different redundancies. So that will proceed. I mean, it's a matter of operations and procedures when that takes place. There's many activities going on in the space station. Many checks have to take place and many operation activities have to be prepared before something happens. So I'm waiting eagerly for the next step. I'm not entirely sure when it will be, but hopefully before too long.
Now, what I was surprised to find out, I don't know why, but I sort of assumed that the antenna would be pointing down towards the Earth, but it's not, is it?
No, that's the whole point of data relay. The space station's travelling 47,000 miles an hour, passing over ground stations anywhere 2 minutes to 12 minutes coverage if you're lucky. So it's like trying to use an iPhone on a train. It's really very frustrating as the coverage comes and goes. So COLCA points up to a geostationary satellite, the EDRS satellite, which it can see for a good 40 minutes of the orbit, and the signals bounced off the data relay satellite back to Earth in Harwell.
And the speeds that this is going to produce, give us an idea of what speed, and also compare it to what's being used at the moment, particularly for astronauts.
Well, the NASA system is VAR, TDRS, the NASA Telecoms Data Relay Satellites. So they have some 300 megabits in a standard link via the TDRS system. But that's for the entire space station, for absolutely everything. COLCA will give the European astronauts a dedicated 50 megabit link to ground. So, you know, analogous to a good home broadband for most people these days. So they'll be able to get a significant amount of data back to the ground in real time. And also the return link's 2 megabits, but that is ample for welfare services, for commanding the payload, for doing, you know, experiments and operations in real time. And the key thing is it's dedicated to the European astronauts. If they want bandwidth on the NASA system, it has to be booked in. It's only short periods of time. It can't be, you know, reactive. So they've really got a good link that's theirs to use as the European astronauts want to.
Yeah, so it's amazing the benefits then, because as you say, it's not just for astronaut communications. You mentioned experiments there in real time. So researchers on the ground in Europe, this is going to be a massive boost for them in terms of sitting there waiting for data.
Yeah, I mean, most experiments get sent up and every now and then a bunch of data will come back down again and the scientists will analyse it. This now gives the opportunity to do things almost in real time because you can command from the ground an experiment. You can make changes to it and get the data almost instantly, you know, seconds of lag later. So it opens up a whole new range of experiments that can take place and much more timely data to the ground for things that are more, you know, time critical.
Now, in terms of what you've learnt from building and designing this, and obviously eventually when it starts operating, will this have applications further than the Earth in the future?
Very much so. We hold a contract already with ESA looking at deep space gateway communications, focused on lunar base station terminals. It's all the same technologies, the same problems. We were part of a study which ESA let last year looking into the architectures for lunar and planetary communications, and we were with SSTL and Goonhilly. We are the contract holder for the RF distribution network for the Deep Space Gateway for the HLCS.
HLCS again, sorry?
The human communication and landing support system. I'll have to check that one, actually.
Something in that. We'll get that.
It's the support system for the...
It's those words, but not necessarily in the right order. We've got those words.
The HALO Lunar Communication System.
Are you sure about that?
Very sure.
Okay, good.
So we're under contract to Thales for that. And there's a new initiative out from ESA at the moment called Moonlight, which we're hoping to be working on, which will also look at future mission architectures for lunar and deep space communications as a PPP to stand up a full communication system led by Europe for any user on the moon. And, you know, having done Colca has enabled us to be at the heart of all of that.
That's great. Well, congratulations and lovely to know that there's a good bit of British kit on that space station.
Thank you very much.
David Kenyon, Managing Director of MDA UK, which built the new Colca antenna on the space station.
Our guest is Katia Moskvich, author of Neutron Stars, The Quest to Understand the Zombies of the Cosmos. I do like that.
I've got
the
book here. Title.
It's a very good title. Okay, so question number one, what are neutron stars? Because it's not just one type of, it's a whole kind of gamut of stars, if you like, group of stars.
Yeah, neutron stars. I mean, they're called stars, but they're effectively not stars anymore. So, and I think the name zombies is incredibly fitting because they are undead. If you take a star like our sun, for example, when the sun is going to die, because it is going to die, not very soon, so, you know, no worry there, but once it dies, it's going to be a really boring death. It's first going to swell and become a red giant, and then it's just going to kind of dwindle and become this really boring object we call a brown dwarf, which you can't really see, and it kind of stays in space forever, and, you know, nothing is going to happen to it for a very long time. So, you know, pretty boring. But if you take a star which is much more massive than the sun, from about 8 times and more, 8 to 20 times more massive than the sun, well, once it dies, it's going to go out with a bang. It's going to explode in a supernova explosion, and we're going to see it in optical telescopes because it's going to be really pretty. And even like with the naked eye, people used to see them before as well. So suddenly the star just becomes much brighter. But in fact, there is no star anymore. It's just an explosion in space. And what's left behind is this core of the star made of iron. It's a tiny object about 20 kilometers across, and it's still a sphere. So if you imagine, for example, the city of Manchester curled up into a ball, this is how big it is. And it doesn't radiate heat, so we can't see it with optical telescopes. It's spinning, and it's spinning actually quite rapidly. Some of them spin at about 600 revolutions a second. And they radiate radio waves from the two magnetic poles, and we pick up this radiation as pulses because, you know, neutron stars spin, and whenever they are in the field of view of our telescopes, of our radio telescopes, we pick up the pulses, and that's why we call them pulsars.
They're quite fascinating, aren't they? These incredibly dense pits of matter, which is sort of unfathomably dense, spinning around. What made you interested in them specifically, particularly as your background is engineering? Was it the fact that these are just quite extraordinary objects in the solar system?
Well, my first degree is engineering. My second degree is journalism. And my third degree, postgrad, is actually theoretical physics.
How inadequate do you feel,
goodness.
Sue?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Okay, you might have just beaten Susie Imbanel.
Well, we're out, definitely, aren't we? Yeah.
No, I shouldn't encourage competition between women, both of whom I admire very much, because Libby Jackson from the UK Space Agency could well be listening, and I'm pretty sure she will want to apply as well. Anyway, but sorry, so yes, you've got three. This is amazing. So you've got, yeah. So, yeah, so did you study neutron stars then while doing your theoretical physics?
I studied dark matter, and dark matter, so I specialized in dark matter specifically, and this is kind of part of the neutron star book as well. Yeah, I went into physics because I was writing so much about physics and astronomy, and so I decided to get a degree in physics to actually understand what I was writing about, if that makes sense, because at times I would write a super complex feature on something, you know, some new discovery, and I wouldn't exactly be able to understand the whole story, and it annoyed the hell out of me. So I went to King's College London. I remember going to the director of the physics faculty, and I said, David, look, I was working at Nature at the time. I said, I'm writing about physics. I don't understand everything 100%. I have to get a degree. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, you know, I wish more science journalists were like that. So he was very, very impressed. So that's how I got my MPhil in theoretical physics.
What was your original question about neutron stars?
neutron
stars? Yeah, there you go.
Got a good story.
But I mean, the point is, because I mean, when these are first discovered, that the pulsars, this beat, there was this idea that it could be aliens, or they were just maybe some odd object. But the point is, like you said, with dark matter and everything's, this is all interconnected. And by studying these, you can tell so much more about the universe.
Yes, exactly. So why I decided to write a book on neutron stars, I was at a conference that was in August 2017, and the conference was for the 50th anniversary of the discovery of the first pulsar in 1967. And I remember people kept talking about something in hush-hush tones, and I couldn't understand or hear them because they knew I was a reporter, but they wouldn't tell me what they were talking about. And I was like, oh my God, what is going on? And then at the end of the conference, I missed my bus and I had to get to my Airbnb. So this guy shows up. It was one of the astronomers, Matthew Bales, actually quite a well-known, as I found out later, astronomer from Australia. He gave me a ride and he told me, he said, I'm going to tell you a story. It's going to be the biggest story of your career. He was very careful because he was under embargo, so he couldn't say this actually happened. But basically, he told me about two neutron stars colliding in space. So that was the famous story. It was all over the media in, back then in August, or well, actually not in August, the paper came out in October. So he told me, you know, what if they were to collide? What if this was to happen? Then it would send gravitational waves and we would, you know, prove Einstein right. And so it did turn out into a beautiful story on this merger of these two objects. And then an editor from Harvard University Press reached out to me and asked me to write a book on anything. And I thought, well, I just wrote this big piece on these two amazing objects and I don't know much about them. So wouldn't it be great to find out more and write a whole book? So this story, this merger of two neutron stars kind of prompted me to start researching. And I found that actually there wasn't there weren't a lot of books written on pulsars, and still aren't, I don't think, not for general audience anyway. So this is how it all started.
And what I like about the book, it's really a travel log. It's your travels to see these various places. And you've gone to some very cool places and very cool observatories and radio telescopes, like the Parkes one in Australia, which I've also been to, which is also fantastic. But it's also that scientific process, because I think that's so many science books can just be very factual. You've got the facts in there, you've got the science in there, but it's the travel aspect I'm really fascinated by, and the sort of scientists you meet along the way.
Yeah, I mean, when I started researching the book in the early days, I thought, okay, how am I going to make it work for a general audience? Because indeed, not everybody is going to be interested in neutron stars. Okay, I find them fascinating, but, you know, would my mom be interested in the merger of two neutron stars? Probably not, you know, even though she is a very curious person. She's a pediatrician, but it doesn't mean she would necessarily read it. So I thought, okay, I have to turn it around and I have to talk about the people behind these discoveries, because then I will interest a lot more people who are not even necessarily interested in the science of it. And for that, I thought, okay, I'm going to go to all these amazing places, to all these observatories, and I'll try to take my readers with me. I'll try to describe these places, describe the atmosphere, talk to the few people who still work there. Because 10 years ago or so, astronomers used to go to the observatories and observe being there on location, but not anymore. Right now, they could be sitting in their office at university and operating a telescope in Australia or something while being in the US. But it doesn't matter, you know, still I found people who are still there and who remember astronomers buzzing around and remember. And so there's this nostalgia that comes across, and people's faces just light up. And when I interviewed other people who were not necessarily there, but even speaking to them on the phone, but because I went to that place where they were maybe 10 years ago, it was a completely different conversation. So I think it really helped me take my readers to the places where they wouldn't necessarily or probably won't necessarily go ever in their lives.
That's great. And as someone who used the same technique for Wally Funk's Race for Space, I can totally relate to why you did it that way. I think not least because I think it's more interesting for the reader, but I also think it's more interesting to write. And you've got something that you're spending years on. You've got to really like what you're writing. Otherwise, it'll be one of those projects that you would come to resent in a way. Now, I've not read it yet because Richard's been reading it, so I'm really looking forward to reading it. Do you interview or do you meet Jocelyn Bell Burnell at all in this? I can't imagine you not.
Yes, I met Jocelyn. She's amazing. She's such a lovely, lovely person. We met in Oxford. She's a visiting professor now at Oxford University. But before I met her in Oxford, I went to Cambridge to see what remains of the array that she used in 1967 to discover, to find that first pulsar, which she indeed called, as Richard, you were saying earlier about aliens. She, because she didn't know what it was, so her and her colleagues, it was a really tight group of people, and they actually kept it very secret because they didn't know what that weird pulse was. So they called it LGM, Little Green Men, LGM-1, and then they spotted LGM-2, 3, and 4. So by the time they found four of them, they knew it weren't aliens, of course, but something else, a new object in space. But she still laughs about it because she was telling me how she was doing her PhD at the time, and she was about to finish the PhD, and suddenly, and that was the project on using this array in Cambridge was on something completely different, interplanetary scintillation. And when she spotted the weird signal and they thought for a few months that it might be aliens, she told me, you know, half jokingly, of course, you know, here I am trying to finish my PhD thesis and this silly bunch of aliens is trying to kind of screw it up for me. So she's super funny and she's an amazing person. She's still giving lectures all over the world.
Yeah, so. I heard her give a lecture actually earlier last year, just before the pandemic, actually, just before lockdown. And it was wonderful to see her treated like a rock star. All these, it was a conference for women, young women in physics. And she was just surrounded by women just going, oh, you know, desperate to talk to her. So it's lovely that you've got her in that, because she's somebody, I think, who brings humanity to the science that she does and makes it understandable and totally relatable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, she didn't get, what really makes me sad is that she didn't get the Nobel Prize, yeah. But her supervisor did, right? Mm. Anthony Hurisch. And he didn't discover the pulsar, she did. So this is completely, I think, unacceptable. But she's totally cool about it. She, of course, went on to win many other awards and recognition. And but she still, another anecdote she told me, she said at the time when she was interviewed about the discovery, she said, yeah, and so the reporters asked me very important questions, like, for example, who I was dating at the time.
Oh, some things don't change, do they?
What's always disappointing with this is we now know that pulsars aren't aliens. It's almost certain that fast radio bursts will turn out not to be aliens. You know, the more we discover about the cosmos, the more fascinating and amazing it turns out to be, but the less likely there are to be aliens.
I disagree with
that.
Richard
wasn't really
on
a question,
yeah.
But
I don't agree with that.
Thank you.
I think it would be silly to assume we are the only, you know, intelligent beings out there. When
did
we
you hear
are
that,
just,
Richard? She said silly.
Exactly. So we're just a tiny planet in a tiny solar system somewhere on the outskirts of one single galaxy when there are so many more planets and, you know, galaxies out there. I'm pretty sure. And with all the habitable planets we've found so far, I'm pretty sure there must be some kind of life. If not intelligent, then at least, you know, on a very basic level. But I'm pretty sure we're not alone.
Well, that's me told. Katia, thank you very much. Katia's book is Neutron Stars, The Quest to Understand the Zombies of the Cosmos. It's really great. I do recommend it. Some great pictures as well. There's one, I've got an almost identical picture. You're standing in the middle of the Parkes dish in Australia. I've got one almost the same.
And are you wearing a dress?
I wasn't wearing... No, that's true, actually. I wasn't wearing a dress.
Sorry. Just checking.
So almost exactly the same. Yeah. Yeah. Katia, thank you so much. It was very good talking to you.
Great. Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
In a moment, we'll celebrate the fast living life of America's first man in space, Alan Shepard. This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with The Naked Scientist. Do get in touch on Facebook or Twitter. You can also email us at, and it's a slightly different email this time, podcast@spaceboffins.com or info@boffinmedia.co.uk.
Now, I only put the two emails in because one, it seems to work intermittently.
Oh,
it
right.
Should work. And it works from some people. It doesn't work from others.
Right.
It seems to be discriminating. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, if you're new to Space Boffins, do subscribe to the podcast and maybe you could write a review, only if it's good, of course, but not before you've listened to our next item.
Over the past few months, we've chatted a few times about Alan Shepard. In May 1961, he became America's first astronaut and the second man in space. He was grounded after he developed an inner ear disorder, which led to severe dizziness, vertigo and nausea. Not great for an astronaut. But following a successful experimental operation, he landed on the moon 50 years ago as commander of Apollo 14.
50 feet per second, looking great. 20 feet, 10, 3 feet per second, contact now.
Two, stop, brake, throw, auto.
We're on the surface.
Okay, we made a good landing.
Roger, enters.
413 plus 10,000. That was a beautiful one.
Alan Shepard's portrayed in the new TV series The Right Stuff as fast-living, womanising and with a poor relationship with the media. So, is that true? Well, to find out, I've been speaking to Neil Thompson. He's the author of Light This Candle, The Life and Times of Alan Shepard.
One of the things that drew me to him and his story in the first place was that we knew so little about him. You know, we knew the high-level stuff. First American in space, fifth man on the moon, hit golf balls on the moon. But as a personality, he was always kind of cagey and elusive and standoffish And he really was those things. I think the reason we didn't get to know him is because he went out of his way to keep the press and to keep the public at a distance. I think he viewed his job as an astronaut the same way he viewed his job as a Navy test pilot. Just put your head down and do the work and be the best. I mean, he was super competitive. So when he died in the late 90s, I was working as a journalist at the Baltimore Sun newspaper and thought, huh, there's no biography about Alan Shepard. He had co-written a book with Deke Slayton, Moonshot, that gave a little glimpse into his personality, but we really didn't know him. And so many of the other early astronauts had books written about them or wrote their own books. So I wanted to dig in and get to know who was this guy and how did, what was it about his personality that led him to that place where he was picked to be first? How does a guy end up being the first guy into space? I wanted to really dig into his personality.
The film The Right Stuff hints at this, but the TV series very much goes into this, that he was this womanizer. He epitomized that fast living, almost like Mad Men type figure in the late 50s and early 60s. How realistic is that portrayal of him?
I think it's pretty realistic. I mean, some of the specifics are obviously fictionalized and they played with that, but that's who he was. He definitely was a Don Draper kind of guy. I describe him in the book as showing up at a backyard picnic with a suit and tie, you know, looking dapper. He drove a fancy car, this Corvette that he drove for years and years. So he was a slick, partying, womanizing, flirty guy. It's definitely who he was. And he had a wife who had died just weeks after he did, so I was never able to interview her, but I did talk to his daughters and other family friends, and it was something that she was kind of aware of and just turned an eye away from it and just kind of accepted it as part of the deal. She joked at one point what do you expect from a sailor?
But NASA must have accepted it as well, because, you know, they wanted this, you know, portrayal of the ideal of going into space. But that must have been a risk, really, knowing what he was getting up to. I mean, it was one of the reasons Gordon Cooper was almost sidelined, because he was having a messy divorce.
Exactly. Yeah. I if you look back, I think the risks that NASA took during those years are remarkable. You know, taking risks on these guys who were, they were bad boys, especially Shepard. And there were a lot of things that NASA accepted because they wanted that persona. They wanted this sort of test pilot, badass personality to represent who the astronauts were. But in inviting that personality into their world, they had to accept the womanizing and the fast cars and these like ridiculously dangerous stunts in airplanes and helicopters.
Isn't there a story of him flying very low over a beach and sort of knocking swimming costumes off people, and you know, it's just as one example,
right? Buzzing the beach in Florida. I forget what the name of the beach was. I think it was Gordon Cooper who buzzed the tower because he was mad about a delay in one of his flights. Prior to that, Shepard was notorious for flying under bridges and upside down and doing loops and all this crazy stuff. But that's who these guys were.
Did he change between his first flight, the Mercury flight, and his Apollo 14 flight? Obviously, he was grounded in the interim. He lost one of his friends, Gus Grissom, in the Apollo 1 fire. Was it a different astronaut that landed and walked on the moon?
I think very much so. I think that really shook him, and I get into that in the book a little bit. He lost a good friend. He was angry about what he felt was a sense of complacency that had slipped into the program. At that time, he oversaw the astronauts. He was the astronaut program director, and he really pushed all the astronauts under his control to train harder and work harder and get past that sense of complacency that had slipped in. So I think that sense of humility and teamwork became part of who he was later on in his astronaut career.
He was slated to fly Apollo 13. It's often said that he wasn't ready, so they bumped him. The crew wasn't ready, so they bumped them to Apollo 14 with a total of, 15 minutes, 22 seconds flight experience between them.
Yeah.
I mean, were they ready? I mean, is that a bit unfair on him? And this idea of the rookie crew, is that also a little bit unfair?
I think it's a fascinating sort of footnote to Apollo 14 was that the other two astronauts had not been in space yet, where some of the other Apollo astronauts have been up multiple times. So you've got two true rookies, and then you've got Shepard, who's been up for 15 minutes. I do think that decision not to let him take Apollo 13 had to do with maybe not a lack of fully being trained, but also they wanted to make sure this disease that he had been fighting had been fully corrected. He had experimental surgery in his inner ear canal, the area that controls our balance and spatial awareness, all these things that are super important for an astronaut flying a spacecraft down to the moon. So they wanted to put him through the ringer and make sure that this surgery had solved the problem, that he was fully ready, and that he and the other two were fully trained and ready for Apollo 14.
And yet it's remembered for playing golf on the moon, which seems a little unfair when you actually read about what happened during the Apollo 14 mission.
Yeah, some of the details are remarkable. I was rereading sections of my book to remind myself some of those episodes, and even I was astounded at some of the moments where the whole thing would have just been canceled. Not being able to, early in the mission, to dock the command module and the lunar module and having to kind of slam them together and hope for the best. And then finally they latched on and they were able to continue on to the moon. That was a close call. There was a moment where there was an abort signal on the control panel that kept flashing on, and Ed Mitchell, Shepard's co-pilot, like literally tapping on the control panel and watching the light go out. If they hadn't solved that problem, they probably would not have been able to land, because if that abort signal kicks in, it automatically aborts the mission and they'd be pushed away from the moon. So they had to fix that problem. There's a great episode with that flight where they had to wake up this young MIT engineer middle of the night, rush him into the command center and have him come up with a software program within 90 minutes. Otherwise, the mission would be aborted. He did it in about an hour. It took some testing for them to like get it into the onboard computer and make sure it was working. And they had literally a minute to spare before they would have otherwise had to abort the mission. There was the incident as they're descending toward the moon where the radar shows Shepard where he's landing went out. And again, he would have had to abort, although he later claimed that he was going to land anyway with or without the radar.
What's your impression now of him and his space career, or maybe his career, you know, overall, because he, you know, had a successful business career after returning from the moon?
Yeah. You know, one of the things, and you're a writer, you know this, when you go into a book, you think you know what the story is and you have this hoped for outcome. With Shepard, I had that, but also this nagging fear that I would, that the deeper I got into his life, that I would find somebody I disliked, you know, somebody that was not a good person, and was relieved and surprised at all the nuances I found about this guy and his personality, and ultimately found him to be a remarkable human being.
Neil Thompson, author of Light This Candle, The Life and Times of Alan Shepard. So pretty much everything you saw in the Right Stuff TV series or the Right Stuff film was true. What I find extraordinary, or most extraordinary, about Alan Shepard is, we were talking earlier about Yuri Gagarin, you know, not having that name recognition in Russia now. I don't think Alan Shepard's got the name recognition. He was the first American in space.
Yeah, hold on. What everyone's... do you base this on? What do
no,
you base this
but
on?
Everyone's heard of John Glenn.
When you... how,
no, no, no.
How
it's...
do you know this?
Well, no, but you ask around. I bet. I would prepare to bet you.
So this is
prepare
Richard's
to
study.
Bet you this Star Trek mug, this Starfleet Command mug,
no.
that more people have heard of John Glenn than they have of Alan Shepard.
Yep, you're on. 50p.
Okay. No, 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 that mug.
No, not the mug. The mug's too valuable.
I don't think that many people have heard of Alan Shepard.
I just think you're just making this up.
No, really, they don't. He hasn't got the name. Everyone's
in
heard
where?
Of John Glenn.
In America?
In America. John Glenn has got the big name recognition. People, if you ask about astronauts, Buzz Aldrin is probably going to be the top
All
one.
Right, I just want to see the proof on this.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to... well, we have to do a survey. Buzz Aldrin, I reckon, is going to be the top one. Maybe Neil Armstrong among a certain... level, but I don't think if you went to the schools. You said the schools, no one heard of
that. Was
Valentina
a school in Britain about Valentina Tereshkova.
I don't think people have heard of Neil Armstrong. I think John Glenn's got Rich. Reasonable name recognition. I don't think people have heard of Alan Shepard. No, I think. Well, I'm gonna investigate this further. I'm pretty certain. I think you will be.
America
I think you'll be depressed
is so
about
nationalistic.
It.
They know they're heroes. I've got my head. I literally have my head in my hands.
I think you just think better of people than they are.
If you've any thoughts, I don't say this now after listening to this. On anything we've talked about, do drop us a message or comment on the usual social media platforms, particularly if you're listening in America. By our next podcast, we'll know if the three missions due to arrive at Mars have actually made it successfully. So we'll definitely be talking about Mars.
Thanks very much to the UK Space Agency for supporting the podcast, and thank you for listening.